The statements and opinions expressed in this episode are those of Dr. Sigmund and his guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of Veradigm.
It's time to do healthcare smarter. This is Smart Medicine, hosted by Dr. Scott Sigmund and powered by Veradigm. If I asked you to tell me what value I provide as an orthopedic surgeon, I bet most of you could answer that pretty quickly. Hey, Dr. Sigmund, you fix people. You help them get better. And that feels pretty straightforward, right? But what if I asked you to tell me how valuable I am? And more importantly, to pay me accordingly? Yep, that gets a little more awkward. Suddenly, it's not so easy to put a price tag on care. That, my friends, is the heart of value-based care. It's a model that ties compensation to outcomes. And it's now stepping into the ring with a long-standing fee-for-service model, and that's not going to be easy. As much as I want to dive headfirst into this potentially smarter approach to care, there are still a ton of questions. Ones I have, ones my mother Judy has, and ones that I know doctors from all across the country will be asking as well. Today, we're getting answers. I called in the big guns, Dr. Kevin Bozek. His credentials? Too many to count. He's the chair of surgery and perioperative care at Dell Medical School at UT Austin, where he literally built the department from scratch. He's also a past president of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and a longtime champion for value-based care. All right, so as we dive deeper into value-based care, it's time for another industry checkup, a little pulse check on where things stand. Now, if you're in the healthcare world, you've probably noticed everyone is talking about value-based care these days. But is the market actually backing it up? Well, yes, and it is big time. In 2023, the global value-based healthcare services market was valued at a whopping $1.33 trillion. And by 2033, we're looking at projections north of $4.13 trillion. That's a compound annual growth rate of 12%. So yeah, this isn't a passing fad, it's a full-on movement. So what does that mean for all of my innovators tuning in? It means now's the time to be thinking about how you can ride this wave. Because value-based care isn't just the future, it's happening right now. Today on the Smart Medicine Podcast, we're honored to welcome a true leader and innovator in orthopedic surgery and healthcare delivery, Dr. Kevin Bozek. He has been a pioneer in rethinking how we design, deliver, and pay for healthcare to improve outcomes and affordability for patients. His career has uniquely blended surgical excellence, policy leadership, and a visionary approach to healthcare transformation. Dr. Bozek, welcome to Smart Medicine.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure, Kevin. Look, you have an incredibly impressive educational background. So why don't we just start there? Because I think it sort of will lead into a lot of things that you're doing in your clinical practice at this point. So you got a biomedical engineering degree at Duke, which oftentimes dovetails really nicely with orthopedic surgery, especially joint replacement. Was that sort of an early passion for you and a direction you thought you would go in?
I agree with that sentiment that having a mechanical background helps in our profession. So the history there is my grandfather, who was from Serbia, Belgrade, Yugoslavia, now called Serbia, was an inventor and a scientist, basically the equivalent of the head of the FDA in Yugoslavia at the time. And he actually got his PhD in Heidelberg, Germany, under the guy Albert Einstein. And we actually have handwritten letters at home between my grandfather and Albert Einstein. But that sort of carried down to my father was an engineer and my brother was a computer science engineering major. And I sort of fell into that path, but at the same time, I wanted to apply what I was doing to medicine. And so orthopedic surgery seemed like a natural fit. And I actually always like to say I decided I wanted to become an orthopedic surgeon before I decided I wanted to become a doctor.
That's so funny. It wasn't too dissimilar for me. In 10th grade, I blew out my knee and had an arthroscopic surgery by this great lacrosse player from Johns Hopkins who had become an orthopedic surgeon. And so that was the moment for me where I knew that orthopedic surgery was going to be it. So it's interesting. We share a little bit. So you go off to San Francisco for medical school, but then you come to Boston for your residency. We missed each other just by a couple of years. I did my Tufts residency from 91 to 95. And so you're there from 95 to 2000. So I enjoyed the the anxiety of Henry Mankin breakfast, just like you did, right? One of the worst moments of your life when you get called on, for sure.
That must have been fun. We enjoyed having the Tufts residence. I had Mercedes Von Deck was with me, and I think you had David Jezebar was with you, right, around that time?
Yeah, absolutely. Mercedes as well. I mean, she's still a friend. We just saw each other not too long ago. That's a small world for sure.
Yeah.
So you stuck around. You did a trauma fellowship in Mass General. Was that your chief residency year, or did you actually do another trauma fellowship?
So when I finished residency, I went off to Harvard Business School and got a MBA, and I decided my real fellowship was going to be in adult reconstructive surgery at Rush, and I hadn't seen the inside of an OR for almost 2 years. So rather than going to Rush, the two-year hiatus, Mark Veris let me back at Mass General for a six-month sort of mini trauma fellowship to get my skills back before I went and did my real fellowship.
That's awesome. So let's talk about that, because you really have had a remarkable journey sort of blending clinical excellence with healthcare innovation as well. So I'm curious, like, what sparked your passion for transforming the way healthcare is delivered? And was your Harvard MBA at the business school, was that part of that sort of process or transition?
Yeah, it was absolutely, it transformed my career path. When I was a fourth year resident in the Harvard Combined Orthopedic Program, Herndon came in and was our chair, and he had an MBA. And I really liked the way he thought, and I liked really kind of thinking about problems with him. And I thought to myself, boy, I know a lot about clinical orthopedic surgery and nothing about just about anything else. And it would really benefit me to go learn a little bit more about the rest of the other 84% of the economy at the time. So I chose to get an MBA at a place that did not have a healthcare MBA, specifically because I think a lot of the problems we face in healthcare is because we always say healthcare is different and we don't apply simple solutions that have worked in other industries to healthcare. So I wanted to learn those principles. And I was fortunate enough to have Michael Porter be my first year professor in competition and strategy. And at that time, this was before he started getting interested in healthcare. He was there right at the time he became interested in healthcare, and then 5 years later published his book, Redefining Healthcare. But I made that connection, and that completely transformed the way that I think about healthcare. And it was an example of taking a solution that Porter had applied in every other industry, his five forces model, and applying it to healthcare as a framework for competition based on value that really changed the way I thought and changed the course of my career.
No, it's interesting because, I mean, you quote Porter now routinely as you're giving lectures. We were just together at the OVBC with Zeev Kainz, and you bring him up. So it's fascinating that that was so early on in your career. It's also interesting that you decided to get your MBA, because a lot of young kids will jump right out of college and they'll just get their MBA because it looks good. But you did have the experience of being a surgeon and working in a world-class hospital and seeing the good and the bad and the ugly, and then sort of now being able to sort of bring that in. So it's fascinating now how that was so early on in your career that was important to you. So you do this and you get your MBA, and now you've got a couple fellowships under your belt. It's time to get a job. So you go back out to San Francisco and you work there for a period of time. And then a very unique thing happens, which is very unusual, right? Most people, if they get a call to be a chairman, it's usually at an established program. Nobody takes a job as a chairman for something that's just starting. So you started the orthopedic program at the Dell Medical School at UT Austin. That must have been a really difficult decision. And what was your vision? How has that evolved, and has it come out pretty good for you?
Yeah, so a great question. I just wanted to comment on one thing you said about the MBA. So I did my MBA in 2000, and at that time, it was very unusual for physicians to get MBAs. And when I was applying for fellowships after business school, I couldn't find a fellowship that would take me because I had an MBA. None of them believed that I was going to be a real doctor, to the point where Jim Herndon told me to take it off my CV. And I thought, I just spent 2 years of my life and $100,000 getting a Harvard MBA, and I should like hide that from people. But anyway,
that's crazy. That is a crazy story, backstory. I love that.
It's changed now. So as far as my career path, yes, I started at UCSF. I had a very rewarding career there and sort of moved up the ranks to a full endowed professor and vice chair of a department and at a big established institution and learned a lot about clinical medicine and the business side of healthcare and innovation. And then I reached a point where I realized that if I was going to challenge myself, I had to do something different. I actually looked at a number of at least a half a dozen what you would call more traditional clinical chair positions and was offered a number of positions at leading institutions around the country. And every time I got there, I thought to myself, boy, this feels a lot like middle management. It doesn't feel like I'm going to be using the skill set that I've honed for the last 20 years. And then this opportunity came along to build a department on, it was the first medical school being built on a tier one research university, of which there are only 80 in the country. His motto was, we need to rethink everything, the way we educate, the way we evaluate, and the way we deliver care based on the principles of value-based healthcare. So it was sort of designed for me. It's been a humbling experience being a chair of cardiac surgeons and plastic surgeons and urologists and neurosurgeons. And so
that's a lot of work, brother. There's no egos in any of those people, and everybody has their own agenda. It's interesting because we just saw you at Zeev Kane's Orthopedic Value-Based Conference, and you're like the rock star of the meeting, right? It's standing room only at your talk. I'm not blowing smoke. It's the truth. Afterwards, they line up to talk to you and get autographs, not autographs, but they want your opinion and all the things that are going on. And now I hear you're the chairman of surgery, got all these things going on, but yet you're the past president of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery. You're constantly sought after for international travel and your views and your opinions on orthopedic value-based care. Do you enjoy taking time away? I mean, that crazy busy practice and being able to get out there in the world and be able to share your views, is that a passion for you?
I absolutely love it. It's what keeps me going. It sort of re-energizes my battery. And I'm sure maybe this podcast is like that for you, but I love clinical medicine and I love the platform I have here in Austin and the things that I've been able to do, but getting out and interfacing with people, different segments of the healthcare ecosystem, different parts of the world, different parts of the country is what recharges my battery.
All right, let's start from the beginning, okay? So I want you to walk us through the traditional method of fee-for-service payment in orthopedics. What's good, what's not so good, and what's bad?
I would answer that question a couple of different ways. I would say if you look at the predominant models that are used for healthcare payment, and I like the term payment over reimbursement, but if you look at the way the incentives, let's call them incentives that are set up, there's on one end of the spectrum, there's fee for service, which is the advantages, so-called, are you're aligning the incentives with the work being done, the sort of the units being produced. The disadvantage is it's completely disconnected from what matters to the patient, and it incentivizes more volume and intensity of services, regardless of how it influences health. On the other end of the spectrum is capitation, which basically a payment per life, regardless of how sick or anything that happens to that patient over the course of their life, which incentivizes underutilization of care. And I would argue neither of those are aligned with value. And what we really want is a system of incentives that align our incentives with those of the people that we are privileged to take care of.
So that's great. So in other words, just for our listeners, because my mother Judy's listening, so she's going to want to understand this. So fee-for-service just means basically a doctor does a surgery and he gets paid for it. And if you do more surgeries, you get paid more. And potentially, you might be incentivized to do the surgery over the needs of the patient or what may be best for the patient or what the outcomes may be. A capitated plan is literally they just give you a bucket of money. Let's say you're taking care of 1,000 patients. At the start of the year, they just give you a bunch of money and they say, you do whatever you want to do. And if you run out of money, you run out of money. If there's money left over, you can keep it. And then now let's move into orthopedic value-based care, right? Which is where you live. That's your career has been staked on this. So, let's talk a little bit more about that so we can understand it. So I want to get to the start, which is what's the purpose of value-based care? Is it to produce the best outcomes? Is it to reduce costs for society? Is it to reduce costs for the patient?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that term is often misunderstood and used inappropriately. And I always like to point out that if you Google origins of the term value-based healthcare, The first 20 entries that'll come up are the book by Elizabeth Teichberg and Michael Porter, Redefining Healthcare. And it was defined as a framework for competition based on value, where value is defined as health outcomes achieved per dollar spent to achieve that outcome. And it's no different than how any other aspect of our economy works, whether we're shopping for a car or a restaurant or house or a plumber. We're going to be looking at what we're going to pay and the value that we're going to receive in return for that. And the first principle there that I always kind of remind people of is the value is based on the outcome. If you hire a plumber and they don't fix your sink, I don't care how cheap they are, you didn't achieve any value from that interaction. If we are taking care of a patient and whatever it is that we do to them doesn't improve their health, I don't care how much money you saved, you didn't create any value for the patient. And the other thing is, you said society, and I will just also point out, value in any industry is defined by the consumer, not by the supplier in our case, or not by the third party who's paying for it. It's defined by the consumer. So the only person who can tell us whether or not they achieve value from their interaction with us is the patient.
Yeah. And as far as the patient is concerned, the way our system is set up, really at the end of the day, they just want to come to an expert, get the expert's opinion, have an intervention that has made them better so that they can continue to do the things that they want to do in their lives, right? I mean, they're not asking for, most patients don't walk in the office and ask for grades and ask for some sort of a bill as to how things are going to play out. They trust in the process. So it sounds like orthopedic value based sort of falls into that middle ground, away from fee for service, but not necessarily away from capitation, and then in a process. But at the same time, this thing comes to mind, you get what you pay for, right? You want to make sure, if you are saving money to the system, that the functional patient outcomes are still good. We want the patients to do well, right? At the end of the day, that's why we're doctors.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, I would say if you believe that value can be defined as the health outcomes achieved per dollar spent, again, if you don't improve health, value is zero, period. And so really, I like to think of value just simply as a framework for everything that we do, every decision I make about a partnership, a hire, acquisition of a piece of equipment. How is this going to help me improve the health of the people that come to me care? And it starts with the first conversation with the patient when they come in to see me. Why are you here today? What can I do for you? Well, I have bone-on-bone arthritis in my knee and I need surgery. I said, well, okay, let's talk about that. Why do you need surgery? Well, I have bone-on-bone arthritis. Okay, well, what is it that you can or can't do that you'd like to be able to do? Well, I can do most of what I need to do, but I have bone-on-bone arthritis. And it's redirecting the conversation to health as opposed to all of the other metrics that we're used to discussing in those conversations. And believe it or not, it's not intuitive to most patients, and it's certainly not intuitive to most clinicians to orient your thinking and your dialogue and your shared decision-making around health outcomes.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. Just something just pops into my brain, and I'm going to ask you because it'll be very pointed to get your answer on this. One of the big expenses in joint replacement right now, in particular, is robotics. Right? I mean, these are not inexpensive, and in your model, in particular, if you're going to spend money, the value should be based on the fact that we're improving outcomes. So, are you using robots for joint replacement?
I don't, but you and I are in that generation where we're not quick to adopt new things. So I can't criticize those who do, but just what you just said, they've been around almost 20 years and you'd be hard pressed to find a study, a well-designed study that showed that it resulted in any improved measure that matters to the patient. And so, and that applies to tons of technologies that we use in orthopedic surgery. Robots are a good example, but there are many, many others that I'm sure you can think of that we are quick to jump on technology and not really, and thinking about technology as the endpoint in and of itself, as opposed to how that's going to help us improve health.
So that's well put. So when it comes to these orthopedic value-based programs, one of the things that one of the more well-known programs, I should say, is the bundled payment program that came out of CMS. And you were a pivotal figure in the development and implementation of the bundled payment programs for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services as well, especially within orthopedics. So have these bundled payment programs been successful in lowering costs for the federal government, as well as demonstrating and creating acceptable patient outcomes, which by definition would mean it's valuable?
Yeah, great question. And I think the short answer is probably not. I will say that I'll caveat that by saying when people define value-based healthcare by a payment model, the payment model is a lever to change behavior, to change the way that we deliver care to result in better health outcomes. And so it's just a lever. And if you pay people fee for service, you will get fragmented, volume-driven care. And if you pay people episodically, and say, you know what, we're going to pay you based on that entire episode, no matter how many services you provide, and we're going to hold you accountable to the outcome, you're going to get more integrated, coordinated care. So I would say the good things that came out of that experience is it really integrated the preoperative, operative, and post-acute care phases in a way that never happened before in my career. In my training, we never talked to the post-acute care facilities, the people doing home health. We never talked to the people that were screening our patients ahead of time. We just existed in our silos. So I think a lot of things happened that resulted in better integration and coordination of care and more of a focus on the entire journey or episode in terms of patient selection, appropriateness, and then finally optimizing the efficiency and reducing both the spend as well as the risk of adverse events. What it didn't do is address the overall, whether or not surgery was the right or most effective treatment in the first place. So what it did is it drove up the volume of procedures. So the federal government did not save any money. It got a bad reputation. The episode costs reduced slightly at a little bit lower, the 90-day episode. And that's mostly because we redesigned post-acute care in a way that we relied less on inpatient post-acute care and more on home care or even self-care. But the overall experiment was deemed a failure by most policy wonks. And again, I would argue that's because if you're looking at an episode of care, whether you're designing care or you're paying for care, looking at a 90-day window of a procedure, which is sort of at the end of the very end of the journey, is probably not the place to focus. It's how do I manage that continuum of care? And I think what we need to do now and what we are doing here in Austin is moving upstream from procedure-based bundle payments to condition-based longitudinal payment models that pay for managing a condition such as arthritis, back pain, ligament injury, et cetera, over the course of that injury, in which some cases surgery is beneficial and appropriate, in other cases, it's not.
Dr. Bozek is absolutely spot on. At the end of the day, only the patient can truly determine the value of the care that they have received. It's no different than anything else in life. Value comes down to, was it worth it? Did I get what I paid for? And let's be honest, who's in a better position to answer that than the person living through the experience? So we've hit on a lot already. What value really means, how tech fits into the picture, and where bundled payments have succeeded and stumbled. That's the past. Before we get to the future, this episode of Smart Medicine is powered by Veradigm. Connect with Veradigm to get the data, insights, and tools to do medicine smarter. Next, I asked Dr. Bozek how he's putting all of this into action with his condition-based payment model at UT Austin. All right, I want to sort of roll the bean footage back a little bit just so that our listeners understand. I completely agree with you when it came to the bundled payment programs. I think we really improved patient care. And the reason we did that was we got all the players in the room. So we got the people at the hospital. We got the people that were managing the patient before they were going to have surgery to maximize their care. Patients were going to rehab. So we standardized where they were going for rehabs. And we had doctors come in the room and data does not lie. We had to share what we were doing. Everybody had a different plan. So I do think it clearly improve that episode of care that you're describing as far as the way in which we communicated for our patients, but it sounds like it didn't save money. All right, so again, my mother Judy's listening, and I really want to talk about the diagnostic bundle at this point. So in terms that my mother would understand, in this new system that you're developing or using at UT Austin, how is this new value-based diagnostic bundle going to change the experience and outcomes for patients in their real lives?
Yeah, great question. So first of all, let's call it a condition-based longitudinal payment model. You can call it a bundle, although I have to say bundle has, because of the reasons that you just mentioned, that it is perceived as a little bit of a underwhelming diagnostic, let's call it condition-based. And what's different is there's different ways to do this. You can do it prospectively, you can do it retrospectively through a reconciliation. But when we are referred a patient for the first time for the management of a chronic musculoskeletal condition, let's use knee arthritis as an example, or shoulder arthritis, it triggers a prospective payment, which is for all of the professional services to manage that patient over the course of a year. None of the facility fees associated with that, but all of the, and we can get into that later, but if you bundle in the facility fees, the incentives become really perverse and it leads to influences decision-making. But we are then paid upfront payment to manage that patient. So whether we do office visits, injections, physical therapy, imaging, anything that's done in the professional world, we are on the hook for. So what does that do for me and the patient? It frees us up to do the things that in the bundle, the payment, the amount of the payment is based on actuarial data from payers for claims data on how much they typically spend in the first year after a new diagnosis of an orthopedic condition. And instead of saying, okay, in order to get that, we're going to have to do 3 hyaluronic acid injections and 3 MRIs and arthroscopic surgery, et cetera, we can now pivot to doing things like lifestyle management, cognitive behavioral therapy for chronic pain and depression, weight loss, things that you can't traditionally do for a diagnosis of knee arthritis. So it liberates you from the mother may I prior authorization payment system to spend the money how you see fit and how you helps you achieve the best outcome for the patient, and therefore gives the patient access to all kinds of different treatments that are not available in a traditional for-service model. And we are ultimately held accountable for the outcome from the patient's perspective. So unlike capitation, in capitation, if we got a prospective payment, we could say, okay, see you in a year, and we could keep the money. Well, we are held accountable for that patient's improvement in functional status over the course of that year. We're held accountable to the payer. So if what we're doing isn't working, we've got to shift gears. And in some cases, that means surgery. But what I will say is, if you look at our rate of surgery compared to the rest of our community, it's about 25 to 30% lower in that first year. And I would say it's not because we are more conservative surgeons. It's because we have a whole realm of treatments we can offer a patient who is obese, depressed, limited mobility, all the different things that we see, the comorbidities that we see. We have a whole team of people that can address those things, as opposed to an orthopedic surgeon who's really, their options, I always say, are surgery or sorry, right? That's about it. And so we can offer lots of other things that can help improve their quality of life. And for that reason, we don't always have to trigger surgery as the next best treatment.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like that should be like a gatekeeper model. Like the orthopedic surgeon should be out of that equation altogether. Honestly, first of all, it requires coordination. It requires a lot of subspecialists that you've just mentioned. You've got nutrition involved. You've got psychologists involved. You've got primary care doctors and all these people that are going to be around. So it seems to me like the patient should go through all of that stuff, right? And then when they're not, we're the carpenter. When it doesn't work anymore, send it to us. And every patient that walks in your door has been sent to you to do a knee replacement.
Yeah, and that's, you just hit on probably one of the most valuable parts of this model, is that when you're integrated as a team. So it's not sending them to me. We're all on the same team. We all have a list of patients that we're responsible for. And the ones that are brand new and have never had any other treatments, or they have a BMI of 50, or they screen positive for anxiety or depression, they are not going to consult with an orthopedic surgeon during that visit, because that's going to be a very frustrating experience for them and for the orthopedic surgeon. So the orthopedic surgeons are going to see the patients who are most appropriate to talk to an orthopedic surgeon. That doesn't mean all of them are going to choose orthopedic surgery, but you're not having conversations with people that is not appropriate. And therefore, now the orthopedic surgeon is practicing at the top of their license. And all of the other people on the team, instead of assisting the physician and helping them find surgical candidates, are practicing at the top of their license. So it improves retention and job satisfaction and reduces burnout. And I think that's probably one of the most compelling arguments for organizing care around value delivered to patients.
Yeah. And that, I mean, it's going to be an uphill battle. I mean, I can see it where you guys are. You have this large tertiary care institution. You got all of these people that are surrounded. Now, I sort of want to segue into the next thoughts that I was having here. Orthopedic departments, orthopedic practices, they're businesses, right? They hire people, they pay bills, et cetera. They need to be profitable to sustain the model, to keep everybody going and doing their thing. There's a lot of consolidation that's been happening in medicine at this point. So, for example, my private practice group is now part of a private equity MSO platform called Spire Orthopedics. And my CEO, Chris Fusco, is going to listen to this podcast. We, as the Smart Medicine Podcast, are powered by Veradigm, which is a healthcare technology company that helps companies to improve quality, efficiency, and outcomes. Their CEO is going to be listening to this. And so how does embracing one of these condition-based models or orthopedic value-based care in particular improve the bottom line for businesses that are involved in orthopedic care? And then as a follow-up question, what specific tools are you going to recommend to help these orthopedic practices become better prepared to engage and succeed in orthopedic value-based care?
Great questions. Oh, first thing I'll say is just about our practice. That's a common comment I get is, well, you're at this big, well-endowed university. Our practice, we have 4 orthopedic surgeons and all of us practice part-time. So we're probably smaller. Well, I know we're smaller than the median orthopedic practice in the country. We're not a big academic department like you would have at Tufts or at Mass General or something. That said, so what does it do for the bottom line? And I've worked with Ortho Forum and a number of these other groups to think about how do you scale this model in, you can do this in the fee-for-service world. We do it for all of our patients. We just happen to have better margins and better patient satisfaction if we're in a longitudinal payment model because there's not multiple co-pays and all that sort of thing. But so what does it do? Let's take the payment model alone. If you're able to contract for the management of a condition over the course of the year and you're pretty confident, you have to look at your data and say, does it cost us less than what the actuarial median is for that payer to care for those patients? And if the answer is yes, there's a margin there. And then you can set up a team. Some people do this as a front end to their orthopedic practice. So you can set up a musculoskeletal medical home that sits on the front end. So that's where the patient enters into your system, and out the back end, patients come who are appropriate to be interacting with an orthopedic surgeon. So you make a margin on the bundle, and then you make a margin on the procedure that comes out the other end. So that's one argument. The other is, if you look at turnover, we opened this practice in 2017. It's now, I don't know, we're up to like 42 people or something total, and 4 of those are orthopedic surgeons. We've had 97% retention rate since 2017. Which that's through COVID, the great resignation, everything. So the cost of turnover alone would justify the investment. And then the retention of the people that are going to stay in that practice, not just the physicians, but everybody else involved in that practice, becomes a very desirable place to work. And then we've grown our patient volumes 15% per year, every single year since 2017. So year one, we had no patients. We had to start out and we built the practice. And now we're in year 8 and we're still growing at 15 to 20% a year. So there's a lot of financial reasons, but I would say you could set this up in a way that it's the front end of your practice. And if you look, I mean, I don't know how many partners you have in your practice, but if you think, what would it cost us to have a behavioral health trained social worker that could do cognitive behavioral therapy and amortize that across however many partners you have, and then you never have to deal with a depressed patient ever again. Never have to see that patient on day one. Think about somebody that can help with obesity and you amortize that over all of your partners. You never see a patient who's not appropriate for surgery based on weight criteria ever again. They're not big investments and they have big payoffs.
You've got the answers, that's for sure. And it's definitely going to be an uphill battle. I mean, this is going to be new and different for sure. Innovation always comes with skepticism, especially for people that have been trained in other ways. But I love it. I mean, I think it's a really innovative thought process about really trying to change up the system and create value and then also create margins. Everybody likes to hear the word margin, right? We're going to get paid for our time. What we do is we've all trained very difficult over years to be able to do what we are as experts. So being compensated fairly is good. And then outcomes for the patients is always supreme. All right, so let's move on to another topic, which is technology. Technology is really working its way into modern day healthcare. It's been overdue. It's been everywhere else in our lives, but not so much in healthcare. But technology for the sake of technology can be expensive. And that's a potential conflict when it comes to value-based care. So with the advances in AI and digital health, patient monitoring, how do you envision orthopedic care delivery changing over the next 5 to 10 years that will affect positively these sorts of value-based programs?
Yeah, that's a really important point because, so first of all, we talked about technology earlier, like robots and whether that adds value. And you can add, there are lots of great ideas that come out of the lab and come out of clinical environments that look great and sound great. You got to be really careful when you introduce a new technology that sounds great to understand the clinical workflow and how it's going to impact the clinical team and the patient. I would say the good news about at least where we've been experimenting with artificial intelligence is I think thus far there are lots of opportunities to use it to improve workflow and make our lives better and more efficient and potentially lead to better outcomes for our patients. So let's take Ambient Scribes as an example. I think a lot of people are using them now. We started using them. It frees us up from, you know, typing on our computer when we're talking to our patients and listening to them and then having a note generated at the end. We have AI predictive analytic models that we've developed for helping patients make decisions, patient in shared decision-making models that allow us to take data from huge data sets of patients, patient-reported outcome data, both physical and mental health, and plug that into a predictive analytic model that will help us based on that patient's unique circumstances, their socioeconomic status, their medical comorbidities, their mental and physical health, their likelihood of benefiting from certain treatments like surgery. For us as clinicians, that historically we had to take all those data points and go, well, yeah, they got bad arthritis, but you know they're depressed, but they come from a wealthy background, so they'll have the resources, but they're overweight. Now we can plug all that into a model and get the answer. And it doesn't mean that you're going to use that as the single data point on which to make your decision, but it allows us to sort of capture a lot of different data points and utilize it in a way that allows us to incorporate a whole bunch of disparate information in simplify it. And then the last thing I'll say is I use AI, generative AI, all day, every day in my communications. So I stopped writing emails and slides for presentations, letters that I write to, whether it's to an insurance company or a letter of recommendation. And I just take data, plug it in and say, here's what I need. Need to send a message out that we're going to have a conference on Friday and here's the information. Boom, creates it. And so it's simplified my life a lot and given me a lot of good ideas.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, AI has just been an absolute game changer. I mean, it doesn't seem like long ago when you were in your residency where like the internet didn't even exist. Yeah, it was snail mail and it was picking up a phone, right? And leaving voicemails. That was our world. So we're free now to think better and innovate more because we're not being stuck with the mundane tasks of every day. And I think that really is going to evolve the human species completely. At the Smart Medicine Podcast, as we get towards the end, I always like to ask a question. Regardless of your politics, President Trump calls you tomorrow and says, Kevin, I want you to come on board and be a part of Health and Human Services, whatever your title might be. How are you going to make healthcare better in orthopedics over the next 4 or 5 years? In a short sort of summary, what kind of changes would you make that would benefit us all?
So, ironically, yeah, we'll keep politics out of it, but the U.S. is often criticized for spending more per capita on healthcare than any other developed country in the world. We spend about 20% of our GDP on healthcare. If you look at what we spend on social welfare in this country, including housing security, education, food security, criminal justice system, it's about the same as any other OECD country in the world. It's about 40%. We just happen to believe in this country that the path to better health is more healthcare. And why is that? Because we have incredibly powerful lobbies like the American Hospital Association, Big Pharma, Big Devices, the American Medical Association that advocate for all of those social welfare resources to be put into healthcare. The rest of the world has figured out that there's other things that influence your health. So if I was given a role in HHS, the first thing I would do is reframe everything that we're doing from the way we organize and deliver care to the way we pay for care, the way that we educate patients and how they access the system around the primary focus being improving health. And I'm very bullish that this current administration, despite some of their limitations, has that orientation. I've never been more bullish about the opportunity to implement some of these principles around value-based healthcare than I am right now.
That's fantastic. All right, give us what you want to do about fee-for-service in particular as a commentary you want to do there.
Yeah, so you said at the end that this is an uphill battle. Couldn't agree more. I've been pushing this boulder uphill for 20 years. I get the naysayers everywhere I go. The one thing I will say, for better or for worse, as fee-for-service has not gotten easier, it's gotten harder, right? So if you look at overhead, it's gone up, whether you're the supply of your workforce or the technology, it's going up at a faster pace than fee-for-service rates are. And so, and now we layer on top of that the headaches with prior authorization. The challenges with fee-for-service have never been greater, my career. And so when people say, yeah, I want to hold on to this fee-for-service model, there's very few people I know that like that model and feel really like, oh, this, I feel great when I wake up in the morning and going and practicing in that model and having to look at my bottom line every week and am I making ends meet and doing enough imaging and surgery and et cetera, and watching my margins decline every year. The only way to make up for that is by doing more and more and more. So I look at fee-for-service as a race to the ultimate race to the bottom. And I think we're getting close to a tipping point. We're going to see people dropping out of Medicare and other things where the fee-for-service model is going to collapse under its own weight. It will always be there, but the attractiveness of it, I think, is declining and declining rapidly at this time. And that's a good thing for zealots of value-based healthcare like me.
I'd add a clinical scenario to that too. Like I recall midway through my career when I was told that you're doing too much knee arthroscopy and the results aren't very good. And there was incredible hesitancy to change the way in which we were thinking about knee arthroscopy. But now, literally, I mean, nobody does knee arthroscopy and removes menisci anymore. We're trying to save the meniscus. So change can happen. It does require a tremendous amount of energy within the healthcare space in particular, because doctors are trained. They spend a tremendous amount of time being trained, not just on clinical medicine, but on the business of medicine. And it takes a long time for that change to evolve. But thanks to leaders like yourself, the fact that you've had this remarkable journey, blending your clinical excellence, developing a program, developing a department, as well as the healthcare innovation and the way in which we're changing models and how we're getting paid, I think is really outstanding. You've been an amazing guest. Kevin, we can't thank you enough for the time you've taken out of your busy day to join us to make us smarter about medicine.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. And I'd like to finish with one comment that I couldn't agree more with everything you just said. I think if you were to ask me what is the rate limiting step to change for the better and for improving the system, it's us. We need to be change agents and not preservers of the status quo. And there are far too many physicians and clinicians in medicine that they see their lot in life as digging their heels in to preserve the status quo. We need to be the ones pushing change, not resisting change, because we're the people that our patients trust to lead that kind of change. We don't want bureaucrats, insurance companies, politicians pushing for change. We want us to be the ones doing that. And I'm very bullish that we have a lot of very talented, energetic, innovative physicians, I'm sure many of whom get to participate in your podcast, who are going to lead that charge in those changes.
Man, I could have talked to Dr. Bozek for hours. His perspective on value-based care isn't just insightful, it's actionable. From redefining how we measure success in medicine to building smarter models that actually work for patients and providers, he's showing us what the future of healthcare can look like. To me, that's smart medicine. Thanks for tuning in to Smart Medicine. If you've liked what you've heard, do us a favor. Follow the show and leave a rating or review. We've got more amazing conversations coming your way. Until next time, this is Dr. Scott Sigmund.